I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday afternoon. Our guest this hour says the NFL has been doing the same thing for about 20 years when it comes to reported incidents of domestic violence among its players, which is, first of all, kind of deny and ignore. If a case reaches the point of an arrest or an indictment, they're likely to claim, well, we're going to let the criminal justice system run its course, and these players have due process rights. But all the while, they don't really do anything. Jeff Benedict is our guest. The first part of this hour, he has written extensively on this issue. He's a special features writer for Sports Illustrated. He's written about athletes and crime, and his books include Public Heroes, Private Felons, Athletes and Crimes Against Women. It was published during his first year of law school. Pros and Cons, The Criminals Who Play in the NFL, Athletes and Acquaintance Rape. He recently wrote an op-ed, The NFL's Willful Ignorance on Domestic Violence, which appeared in the LA Times. A little bit later this hour, Goldie Taylor will join us. I heard her on Point a couple weeks ago. She was discussing domestic violence and child abuse. She is a victim of both. She has an incredible story to tell about her childhood and also being assaulted by a partner of hers. She is a political analyst and on-air contributor at MSNBC. She will be with us hour two. The full hour will welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Would you agree with our first guest that most of what the NFL has done in the last 3 weeks has been reactionary or reflexive? And would it make sense for the league to put forward the many, many players who are stand-up people? And what the league really needs is for those people to be the ones who are speaking, not only to the public, but also in the locker room. We certainly welcome your phone calls this hour. And Jeff, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be on.
I'm interested that you've been following this story for a long, long time. 1997, was that the first book?
No, actually, I started in the early 90s, right around the time that O.J. Simpson was charged with killing his wife. I was in graduate school at the time and applying to law school, and I was doing some research on the connection between athletes and violence against women. And then once the O.J. Simpson case happened, I started looking more aggressively at the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
And so really for the past 20 years, it's something I've tracked, but I started doing the really heavy research in the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're certainly the expert on the topic. Is there a connection? I've talked about this in my family of football lovers. I'm not included in that group, but the connection, I'm wondering, between this violence that we see on the field in football, it's a pretty darn violent sport that can be carried over into violence at the home. Is there a connection, or is that off base?
Well, the reason I think it's a little off base is because it tends to really skew the conversation. The fact of the matter is there's thousands of guys who play football, this very violent game, and who don't come home and beat their wives or their children or anybody else. So there's clearly a proven ability by most of these guys to not translate what they do on the job to at home. And I think that you can look at the fact that there's lots of other occupations. Basically, there are men who commit domestic violence in every profession, in every city, in every religion, in every race. And so I'm usually try to be careful when we talk about football players to not make it look like this is a football problem, because mm-hmm. I don't think it is.
Okay. The NFL, you have said, has been doing the same thing for about 20 years when it comes to reported incidents of domestic violence. What have they been doing or not doing?
They haven't been doing much, I'll tell you that. I mean, for years, going back to the 90s, I mean, I think it's hard to go prior to the 90s, because the truth of the matter is nobody really connected the NFL and domestic violence in the same sentence until O.J. Simpson. I mean, really prior to that, this discussion didn't exist. And so I think if you start the conversation in the 90s and you come forward, that's when people actually started asking some questions about, well, how does the NFL deal with these things? at the time, how they were dealing with it was by not dealing with it at all. And basically their explanation for that then was to say, look, we put on football games. We're not the criminal justice system. And what happens in that arena is really not our purview. On the other hand, we are interested in things like when players use steroids or when players bet on games, because that gets our fans questioning the integrity of the game.
Mm-hmm.
But what that implies is that when a player beats up his wife or sexually assaults a woman, the fans don't really care about that.
Mm-hmm.
And there probably was some truth to that, to be truth be told, in the 90s. But I think what we've seen since has been this litany, and it's a nonstop one, a nonstop litany of cases that have gotten aired in the newspaper and on television. And so it's created this perception that there's a lot of guys in the NFL doing this, which isn't really true. But what is true is that when they do it, the league looks the other way. They don't treat these cases like they do possession of marijuana or possession of a gun or use of steroids. They've basically just let the justice system do what it does, but the league doesn't do anything. And now we're finally seeing a change where the league is saying that, look, we see this as a serious problem. I think they're doing that because now it's harder to ignore the fact that the public can see it.
Right.
And when the public sees it, it's pretty ugly and it's pretty embarrassing.
Why hasn't the league done anything?
Well, I think one of the reasons is that this is a profession that is run by men, and all of the primary performers are men. I mean, everybody who plays football is obviously a man. Everybody who coaches is a man. And basically the guys who run the league and make all the big decisions are men. And not that men are incapable of you know, doing the right thing on this issue, but in this league, there's been no there's been nothing requiring them or pushing them to do the right thing or to see this for what it is. And I think there's been a lot of people in leadership positions who don't understand this issue at all. I mean, for instance, if you see a video of a man dragging an unconscious woman from an elevator, and in police reports and in interviews with you, he admits that he struck her in the elevator. You didn't see it, but he's admitted that he struck her, and you've seen the video of him dragging her out completely unconscious and dropping her on the ground. If that's all you know, that is more than enough information for you to determine this guy has
right.
a real problem with violence.
Mm-hmm.
And as his employer and as the league who supports his franchise, we can't simply, you know, allow this to pass with a one or two game suspension. This requires much more than that. And that's what the league's been unable to see or do for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. You write about the fact that the Ravens posted a statement on Twitter shortly after that incident saying that Jhené Rice deeply regrets the role that she played the night of the incident. That's pretty amazing.
Yes. It is amazing. Now, the context for that, if you ask the Ravens, what they'll say is, if you look at initially what happened, was that there was an argument between the two. And so she was a participant in that argument, and that, you know, words were exchanged, and, you know, probably unkind words. And that when the police, you know, were first involved, that, you know, they were considering charging her. Of course, the prosecutors didn't do that. When they saw all the facts and
right.
looked at what they had, they didn't charge her. But what you've seen in the past, it was illustrated in this Ray Rice case, which is that oftentimes the finger is turned around, not at the guy who threw the punch or knocked the woman down, but at the woman. And there have been some pretty high-profile incidents in the past where the wives and girlfriends of NFL players have taken the blame publicly for abuse. And so this is not the first time. But when you have the team getting out like they did, that's typical behavior where these teams, where coaches, where PR people will throw a safety net around the player. And sometimes when you do that, it puts all the focus on the victim.
Mm-hmm. And when we are putting focus on the NFL, you said a little while ago that this is in other occupations. It's a very serious problem in this country. But you remind us that NFL players really deserve this attention because they're not like the general population. They make way more money. And they also are examples for youth who idolize some of these players.
Yeah, you know, look, these players, I'm sure if you took a poll, you'd find that a lot of these guys, they don't necessarily want that mantle of responsibility, and they didn't sign up for it. There's no training, by the way, on how to be a good role model. I mean, these guys are athletes is what they are.
Mm-hmm.
But for right or wrong, the reality is that in this country where the culture puts such a great emphasis on sports, that's why we pay them such a disproportionate amount. If you think about it, a guy who can knock somebody down better than the next guy can get paid 100 times more than a nurse or a physician.
I know.
And so that's the reality. So when you're in that situation, we don't get to choose who kids look up to. Kids will make that decision themselves, and we know for a fact that there are millions of boys under the age of 18 who emulate and idolize football players. They're like action heroes, except they're real. And that's the reality. And so I think, you know, when the league or a franchise who puts these guys up on that pedestal has a player do something like this, it's incumbent upon them to do the right thing. And I'm not saying that the NFL and the franchises have to be judge and jury. That's not their role. But as employers, I think they have a big responsibility to not continue to put someone up on a pedestal who's beaten up or sexually assaulted a woman. And that doesn't mean you have to take his paycheck away, but it does mean you should take him off the field.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about men from the inside who need to step up and say, this is a big issue to me, this is wrong, it needs to happen publicly, it also needs to happen inside the locker room. Do you think after all that's happened the last few weeks, we are now having people inside football saying exactly that?
There's no question. I mean, we've had, in the last 3 weeks, one of the bright spots is that some of the most high-profile, respected former players, these are guys in the Hall of Fame, like Steve Young, Ronnie Lott, Jerry Rice, some of, you know, these are the guys that have come out in the last 3 weeks and have been critical of the way these things have been handled, the fact that players who do this are allowed to continue playing. I mean, I'm obviously not a former player, and so players could look at what I say and go, well, what does he know? Who cares what he says? He's not a player. Well, these guys were not only players, they were some of the greatest players in the history of the game, and they're saying these guys who do this should not be playing. And we've also had players who are current players, like Eli Manning, the quarterback of the New York Giants, who's come forward and said how this is really disturbing, and they don't like it. And I think that the truth is there's a lot of guys in the locker rooms who don't like this kind of behavior because they're not those kind of guys.
Mm-hmm.
These are fathers, they're husbands.
Right.
And I think that's why I'm not saying that the league should do this for PR reasons. I'm saying this would be the right thing to do because allowing these guys to get out in front would go a long way to changing the culture and the attitude within the league. And at the same time, it would also change the league's image, which I think is really what drives league behavior, is image. It seems to be more important than necessarily doing what's absolutely right. And in this case, I think they could get both.
Mm-hmm. What about brain injuries? Could they be behind this problem? Some of the players who have been charged with domestic violence have had cases of concussions.
Yeah, I think that that's a leap because there's no, at least right now, there's been no evidence to support the connection between these specific cases and that. I don't know anybody, you know, who plays very long in the NFL that hasn't had a concussion. A lot of these guys have had concussions before they even get to the NFL. But I think before you make that kind of a leap, that's a tough one. You know, it's another story when you're talking about players who have a documented history of damage as a result of concussions, and one of the symptoms is that you see this, you know, really unexplainable behavior in the form of, you know, getting angry, getting even violent at home. And there have been some documented cases of that, including in the book last year that came out, League of Denial, about concussions in the NFL, but I think be cautious about doing that with the current cases.
You also have this huge thing, and that's advertisers who are questioning all of this. I understand that Procter & Gamble, the New York Times had a story on this, has joined the list of sponsors distancing themselves from the NFL. They have pulled the Crest toothpaste brand out of a campaign held in conjunction with the NFL's Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
And Anheuser-Busch, which is a huge sponsor for the NFL, has come out with a statement expressing some pretty strong dissatisfaction with the way the league has handled this whole issue. Those aren't the only sponsors. And I think one of the reasons that the league front office, the commissioner's office, has been under so much pressure of late is that. Because this is the first time in 20 years where this issue of violence against women has actually motivated sponsors to pull back. That's never happened before. And that, to me, is the bellwether of this is changing the debate. Because, you know, the media can complain all they want, write essays and stories, and we can have people on TV squawking about it. That doesn't really get the attention of the league. It doesn't cause them to change what they're doing. But sponsorship pulls, that does. There's two things. It's when fans have had enough. And when you see banners, you know, flying over stadiums,
right,
that's an indication that people are getting fed up.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have sponsors pulling out.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Jeff Benedict is our guest this hour. He's a special features writer for Sports Illustrated and has written extensively. Well, he's written about a number of things, but for our purposes, extensively about athletes and crime. Books include Public Heroes, Private Felons, Athletes and Crimes Against Women. He wrote an op-ed piece that appeared in the LA Times recently, The NFL's Willful Ignorance on Domestic Violence. Here's our phone number. Are you satisfied with the NFL response? Why in the world would the league ignore this issue for the past 20 years? Is it wrong to signal out the NFL when domestic violence is certainly of great concern to our society and is found in people of many different professions? Or is it time for the NFL and the people within it to speak out against this because it's a very large public platform for them to do so? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Jeff Benedict is with us for a few more minutes. A little later, Goldie Taylor will join us. She is a victim of domestic violence and child abuse. She's a political analyst and on-air contributor at MSNBC. Frank in Onalaska, hi.
Hello?
Yes, Frank, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. And while a lot has been said and more needs to be said about the violence and domestic violence, sexual assault in the NFL, I've been waiting for the media to connect the dots to two other examples. One is the college sports arena and the Heisman-winning trophy quarterback, Jameis Winston, is one example. And the second question is related to the similar violent environment in the military. And there's numerous examples, whether it's the Air Force Academy scandals with Tail Hook, and assaults on fellow soldiers right up the line where officers are taking advantage of enlisted men. But the media has failed to address any connection or linkage between college sports and the military and those sources for domestic violence.
All right, what about college sports, Jeff?
Well, I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is I've been writing about college sports and this issue for as long as I've been writing about the NFL. I mean, the book that Armin and I just put out last year, The System, The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football, I mean, we talk about domestic violence in there, and we talk about sexual assault in there. This is not a new topic. It's not a new question. The connection between college sports and violence against women has been made 20 years ago. And the reason you continue to see the issues like the one with Jameis Winston that he mentioned in Florida State is because these athletes that are that good and that talented, and they perform at schools where the football program is the front porch of the university, as is the case at Florida State, there's been a reluctancy on the part of presidents to intervene and do the right thing. In Florida State, for example, in my opinion, and I've said this before, it should not be in the hands of the coach to decide what this player's punishment should be for the kinds of things he's done, both publicly and privately, with women. This is something that the president should have the power and the backbone to step in and do, which is to remove him from the program entirely. I don't think a season-long suspension is sufficient for him. He should be gone from the school because he's the face of that university right now, and that face has not been good with the things that he's done. As far as the military connection, I've never personally written about that, but the truth is there's been extremely good reporting at the New York Times, at PBS, and in independent documentary films about the connection between the military and violence against women. I think that's a connection that's been made, too.
Thank you, Frank, for your call. We go to Marty in Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good afternoon. Say, you keep saying that the NFL's been ignoring this issue for the last 20 years. Were they not ignoring it before that? Because you can't tell me players only just recently started abusing their girlfriends and spouses. I'm also curious what the police were going to charge the young woman. I'm sorry, I don't remember her name. The woman who was hit in the elevator. What were they going to charge her with?
Two good questions. Let's deal with the first one first. The fact is, of course, there were incidents of players hitting their wives before, 1994. But the reality is the league was never questioned about that prior to that. So, in other words, the league hasn't had to answer this to this issue until the earlier mid-90s, and that's why I use that as a jumping-off point. I think it's hard to criticize the league for, turning a blind eye when prior to that, this was never really even brought into their door. But it started being brought to their attention in the 90s, and that's when they started really what I consider a pretty active campaign to try to dispel the idea that this was a problem in the NFL when it was. The second thing with the incident with Ray Rice, they were considering charging her with assault because they had a confrontation prior to getting in that elevator. I mean, I think wiser heads prevailed when they looked at all the facts, and they didn't charge her. And by the way, that's not entirely unusual in some of these cases where there's a dispute, and this isn't just with athletes, but just in general with domestic violence cases. And sometimes law enforcement, particularly ones that aren't well trained in this crime, will sometimes do that and charge a woman in these instances where there's a dispute in the house that ends when he turns violent and knocks her out or hurts her and a 911 call is placed.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the response. Letter evidently calls to the National Domestic Violence Hotline went up 84% during the week of September 8th, the week of this video. The hotline didn't have enough people to answer the calls. Goodell said the league would provide financial support so the hotline could hire, I'm sorry, this just doesn't seem like that many more people, 25 more people. Also promised money and promotional support to the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. What do you think of that response?
Well, what do I think of Goodell's response?
Yeah, is that enough? I mean, does that make a difference?
Well, I mean, anything makes a difference. I mean, whether it's enough is obviously, we can all debate whether they should do more. The league has infinite resources. It's the wealthiest sports league in America by far. And so it's capable of doing a lot more financially. And I think, it should do more financially. But I think where the NFL can really do its bulwark is by using its legion of players, past and present, who have the capacity to take a leadership stand on this issue, which really has never been done before. And I think the fact that you see such a high spike in calls to domestic violence centers after something like that is played, again, it speaks to why the NFL needs to do more and why this is different when an NFL player does it. The crime of domestic violence is domestic violence, no matter whether it's a football player or a police officer or the custodian who comes home and does this. But the point is that when the custodian does it, nobody knows about it. Nobody right. reads about it. There's mm-hmm. no big debate about it. And so the NFL doesn't get to sit back and say, well, this isn't fair that you're putting all the spotlight on us. Well, it doesn't matter if it's fair. It's a fact. It's probably not fair that your guys get paid $10 million to run up and down a field either, but that's a fact too. And I think that that's why they have to be more proactive and more affirmative on this than they have been in 2 decades.
Billy in Kenosha, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Billy.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Billy.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I don't agree with where you brought up children typically idolize and make heroes of NFL players and sports figures in general. I grew up, I looked up to my parents and my brothers, who were all older than me, and I'm in the same line of work. I could see if maybe the children's father was a sports figure and they idolized him in that fashion, but parents kind of lead their kids into sports figures being heroes or idols. And I don't agree with that, and I also believe that the NFL, seeing what's going on with some of the players getting in trouble publicly, should dismiss them completely.
Jeff?
I couldn't agree more with Billy's idea that parents are the great place to start with role models and brothers and uncles and all that, and I certainly looked up to grandfathers and uncles when I was a kid. But there's two things going on here, I think, and this is kind of what you can't help. I mean, is that one of the big things that fathers and sons do is they go to ball games together. And they watch him on TV, and sons see how much their dads love watching baseball and football and basketball. It's something that fathers and sons bond together mm-hmm. doing. And when you see sons, suddenly wearing the shirt of their favorite player and his poster's on their wall and his face is on their Wheaties box and his emblem is on the back of their sneaker, it gets hard to not see and acknowledge that there is some emulation there. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. There's nothing wrong with seeing an athlete and going, wow, that's something to admire because he's really good at what he does. The problem comes in, of course, when the kid gets exposed to his off-the-field behavior and it's negative behavior. If that's the case, it can be a big downer. And all I'm saying is that I think the leagues recognize that, but they also, in some situations, in domestic violence or violence against women in general has been one area that all the leagues, but the NFL in particular, have been really slow to get in front of that and to do a better job of making sure that they don't do anything to enhance the perception that this kind of behavior is okay. And I think hopefully that's what's going to start to change.
Yeah. One more call for you, and then we'll go to Goldie. Angie in Fond du Lac. Hi.
Hi. I just have a couple concerns because I think a lot of the problem is our culture and what we value. And I think a lot of these athletes, we value what they can do on the field and we pay them the money and we give them this opportunity, but we don't continue their education for valuing what they're doing with themselves mentally. And I think that a lot of these problems can be taken care of if we take these players and we take their values off the field also. And we're sitting here and we're, yes, there are kids, even if I have a son, he does not watch TV or does not do a lot of the sports on the TV watching this kind of stuff. But when he goes to school, other kids influence him to look at sports and to take this into consideration. And then he'll come home and he'll want to be more involved in watching sports. And to me, it is a very big concern that these players, after high school or anything like that, when they reach a certain point, it seems like, okay, I've done this, I've reached this point in life, I don't have to continue to care about anything else other than making this paycheck, making the fans keep coming back to these stadiums and making money.
Jeff.
Yeah, and quickly, Angie, what I would say there is, I'm going to argue against you, but to say that the reality is that, and it's not fair to just say this about athletes, but if you take anybody who at 23 years old is earning seven-figure salary,
I know,
I know.
There's not much incentive to care about what you're talking about. I mean, and I'm not saying that to sound coarse. It's just, it's reality. They don't need to think about those things. And these are guys, that's just their base salary. It doesn't include all their endorsements and all the other ways that they make money. And they're in an occupation, frankly, that saps all of their physical energy. Most people don't realize what these guys put into being a professional football player. And at the end of the day, they don't want to do anything else. And so all of those factors go into why there's not much impetus for – it's rare. I guess I'll say this. I know two players in the NFL that really pursued additional education while they were playing in the league. And it's just because they don't need to.
You know, Jeff, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Jeff Benedict, his first book, written in 1997, was Public Heroes, Private Felons, Athletes, and Crimes Against Women. His latest book is The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football, and he has become, because of all of his books and statements about what we've been talking about, a national expert on the subject of athletes and crime. And we have, I believe, on our Facebook page, the LA Times editorial that caught our attention. We're going to continue. Goldie Taylor is joining us now. I heard her on Point last week, I believe it was, discussing domestic violence and child abuse. And she was such a powerful, powerful speaker. She's a victim of both. She is a political analyst and an on-air contributor at MSNBC. She appears on Real Time with Bill Maher, The Ricky Lake Show, Good Morning America, and focuses on gun control, domestic violence, human trafficking, public health, poverty, environmental justice. She's a former Marine, and she often addresses foreign affairs and military issues. She has done work in politics as communications director for the mayor of Atlanta. She's an author. Her first nonfiction work, The Devil and Missouri Daniel, a memoir set in post-Reconstruction-era Arkansas. She was the chief architect of Procter & Gamble's community building initiative, My Black is Beautiful, and did the marketing for CNN's Black in America. And she launched a film and TV production company last year. Her first feature-length documentary is The Other Side of Grace, which charts the rise and decline of her hometown, which happens to be East St. Louis, Illinois. Goldie, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Kathy.
Yeah, you just stopped me in my tracks as I was driving to work listening to you on Point the other week. I thought, oh, my gosh, your stories and where you grew up as well. The issue that we haven't talked about a whole lot is the Adrian Peterson issue. We've talked about violence against women. This violence against a very young child is also so troubling. And the story that stopped me in my tracks was your growing up really with both, with really severe child abuse as well.
You know, it's really unusual that one doesn't include the other.
Really?
It's unusual when you have a domestic violence situation where a husband or significant other is abusive towards his spouse or loved one and is not also abusive towards the children.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're generally follow-on or work-in-tandem situations because when you understand the power dynamics surrounding domestic abuse, it is the power of the entire household and everyone therein.
Mm-hmm.
So they do ride together often. They certainly did in my lifetime growing up in East St. Louis. As children experienced quite devastating physical abuse from not only, our parents and aunts and uncles, but also from neighbors because neighbors were allowed then to strike children if they thought they were so-called acting out. When I was in school in East St. Louis in the 70s and early 80s, corporal punishment was also allowed in schools. And so a teacher, a football coach, a principal could also spank you and then send you home for something else from your parents.
Mm-hmm.
So it really was an entire culture, really, built on violence. I am always amazed to hear some of, even though I experienced it myself, always amazed and very heartbroken to hear some of the stories of some of my contemporaries who, frankly, had it worse than I.
Mm.
I think I said at one point, there wasn't a man in my immediate family who was born before 1986. They were all taken by the streets, driven there by a very abusive household. And so there are no living brothers of mine, no uncles, no grandfathers. My father is not alive.
Goldie.
And so when you look at how the devastation broke down our family. We've emerged really as a family of women, a family led by women.
Mm-hmm. And you told the story on the air of you were beaten by so many males in your family. I believe it was when one of your uncles died, what you and your siblings did.
Yeah, I was 7 years younger than my older siblings, but I sort of grew up with these cousins of mine who were around the same age. And I had a cousin, Buki. His real name is Gerald. I still call him Buki to this day. But we came up in the exact same environment. So the day that my Uncle Ross died, and we loved him. We loved him dearly, despite the abuse that he delivered on us. We knew his intent was, to keep us in line, to keep us out of the street, no matter how wrong-headed the punishment he meted out was. But the day he died, everyone else was, enjoying the repast and having food and laughing about, his life and how he had, contributed, so much to so many people. While my cousin Buki and I went out back, grabbed his old axe, and started hacking down the tree that he used to use to grab switches from. It took us hours to fell that tree. But once it was down, we chopped it into pieces, put it into his old wood pile, and we burned it.
Oh,
symbolically for us, it was, he can't strike us anymore,
mm-hmm.
but this tree will never hurt another child.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that stump is still there today. I was back in New St. Louis just a few months ago filming a documentary. The stump is still in the backyard. And I looked at that tree and said, gosh, we really took it down. I mean, we were 16, 17 years old when it happened.
Why is it? We were talking a bit about with Jeff before you about why it is the NFL has ignored domestic violence for so many years now. And it's not just the NFL. You tell your story, and it resulted in early deaths for the males in your family. But you think about how prevalent this issue of child abuse and domestic abuse is in our society. We still are trying to ignore it, it seems to me. I don't quite get it. Why?
Well, there is a... Well, first of all, for the NFL and for any company, for that matter, when you look at a company's sanctions that they put upon employees or people who work in their work for them, those sanctions are always built on revenue. And there's always a cost-benefit analysis done that says, I'm paying this fella $7 million a year to run a football for me.
Mm-hmm.
If I take him off the field, will I lose fans? Will I lose butts in the seat? Will people buy less hot dogs? Will there be fewer jerseys sold? If I take him off the field for a game or two, will that hurt me? If I take him off the field for an entire year, will that hurt my investment? And so rarely are these decisions made based upon the impact of the lives involved, but for the revenue that's involved. And so when you watch the NFL manage the situation, you watch them manage it from a public relations perspective. When the public relations got bad, the sanctions got tougher,
mm-hmm.
rather than dealing with this right. holistically from the start.
Right. And what about in your family and outside the NFL? Why is it that it was allowed to persist for so long in your family, and your family isn't the only family, certainly, it's all over America, that somebody just doesn't break the cycle of violence and say, wait, this is a very damaging thing for all involved. We have to stop.
Well, there are really two things at play, especially when it comes to domestic violence, among two significant others. It really is our justice system and how it responds and how it has not learned to respond more appropriately to these situations. And so, but you've also got a power dynamic happening inside the relationship where a woman may not want to always report her husband or boyfriend for domestic violence because she feels it may impact his life negatively.
Mm-hmm.
He may be the breadwinner in the household.
Mm-hmm.
She may fear retribution from him.
Mm-hmm.
Women attempt, on average, 7 times to leave an abusive significant other before they are successful. However, in 50% of the cases where the woman is killed, those 50% of the cases were in an attempt to leave.
Oh.
And so she may be doing a cost-benefit analysis herself when she decides whether to stay or go or allow this to persist. In the situation involving children, we as a society, some 75% of us, accept that corporal punishment is good for children, despite all of the known data that says otherwise, despite all of the data that says that you traumatize children from the very start, that you stunt their growth, that you stunt their ability to make moral decisions, that you cause damage at the very cellular level of a child that shortens their lifespan. Despite all of that information and data, we continue to do it because we are, because to reject it means to reject your parents, to reject your grandparents, to reject the people that you know that love you, and reject their discipline upon you. And so despite not having any demonstrable evidence that this does good, but every bit of demonstrable evidence that it has a negative impact, in our society, we continue to embrace it and pass it down like we pass down baseball and apple pie.
But we don't accept everything about the way the parents, our parents raised us. Isn't it natural to go through a phase in life, and a significant one, where you do reject your parents and forge out your own life?
In some ways, there are. For instance, you know, my parents didn't put seatbelts on me when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But my children can't leave the house without a seatbelt. My youngest grandchild cannot get into a car without being in a car seat. I was never in a car seat as a child. And so were my parents wrong about that? Absolutely. But society in general was wrong about that. But in terms of child abuse, in terms of spanking, there is much more emotional yarn caught up in that decision than there is in things like secondhand smoke, which we know is dangerous today. But, you know, back in the day, you smoked at work, you smoked at home. You didn't think it hurt anybody else, let alone yourself. Mm-hmm. We know better. Now we're doing better. I think that even though there is broad support for child discipline in that way today, I think that it will change over the coming decades, but it'll take just that long to happen, just as it has with smoking, just as it has with, you know, wearing car seats.
Mm-hmm. I want to take phone calls for you, but you also, and I know that you've done this publicly, you also had a harrowing story of domestic abuse from a partner who was a whole lot bigger than you and damn near killed you, really.
Yes, he was a lot bigger than me. He really did. I have come to believe that, you know, the men in my family were the disciplinarians growing up, and that the very first significant love in my life, I believed that a man who loved you would strike you.
Mm.
So I took that learning straight out of childhood into my very first relationship. He was more than double my size in weight and in height. I'm 4'11", 100 pounds. I think it was 90 pounds at the time.
Mm.
But he was clearly, you know, 200 pounds and well over 6 feet. And there was, looking back, quite a number of emotional issues that he had for himself that he took out on me. And I watched the power dynamic swirl. I was a young woman. You know, I was 19 years old. And I was one of those women who tried multiple times to just get out. But over the course of time, he had created this island for us, cut us off from family, cut me off from friends, took control of my weekly small paycheck that I earned. So I not only didn't have the financial means to move, I didn't have the emotional or physical means to move. It boiled down one night when I had had enough as a young girl and felt my life in danger. I took a rotary phone as he was attacking me and struck him in the head. And I ran, ran for the door. I felt a piercing in my upper shoulder that I didn't really notice then. It felt like a tingle, but my mind said, keep running.
Mm.
I made it to a neighbor's house, banged on the door, got inside, and the woman said, oh, my God, you've been stabbed.
Mm.
And the scar, you know, remains in my upper right shoulder to this day. I even thought about tattooing it over. But, you know, I look at it as a reminder every once in a while over the journey that I came through and that other women, and men, by the way, come through. There are men in this country who suffer in shame and silence, who never report, who never tell family that the woman in their lives is abusing them. And so it does work both ways, although the imbalance is quite significant. 92% of cases, it is man against woman.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls. Goldie Taylor is our guest, and Goldie is a political analyst, on-air contributor at MSNBC. She has told her story both of child abuse and domestic abuse when she was an adult in various media outlets, and I just thought what she had to say was so striking that we wanted to have her speak to you as well. She She does all kinds of things. She's a contributor, political analyst at MSNBC. She appears on a lot of media outlets. She's done all kinds of things in journalism and launched a film and TV production company last year. Her feature-length documentary is The Other Side of Grace, which charts the rise and decline of her hometown, East St. Louis, Illinois. We should talk to her about that down the road. We will. Phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls for Goldie Taylor. And we start with Joanne in Chicago. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, thanks for letting me talk with
sure.
you today. I'd like to make two points. One, back to the Ray Rice story, or just football in general. I really do think the NFL's decisions that they make and how they've handled the various violent scandals that have come up in the NFL in the last 20 years and way back before that has boiled down to money. You're talking revenue for the owners, for the franchises, and they let it go on, and they won't do anything about it because of money. I mean, think of it this way. If Ray Rice or Adrian Peterson or Hardy were the 51 man on the roster versus the number one man or number two man on the roster, they would have been done in football when they committed these acts of violence.
All right, I need to hold you there because we have a short period of time. Goldie, what do you think?
I have to absolutely agree with that. I think, you know, being the first man versus the 51st man does make all of the difference. I think the team, reading through the reports from ESPN especially, reading through that shows you that the Baltimore Ravens and the NFL really conspired to keep this issue minimized, to minimize his punishment, and to make certain that that tape, that devastating tape we all saw, would never come to light. Unfortunately for them, and fortunately for us, it did come to light, and we were able to speak more openly about these issues.
Thanks, Joanne. Elaine in Colfax, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say something about Ray Rice, too, is I felt like he was sincere because he didn't act like a couple of appointments at a therapist was going to fix him. He said that he and his now wife were going to get counseling together and that he hoped that he would dedicate his life to this issue. And although he hasn't, obviously his career in mind, and I just felt like there was a sincerity and a possibility of redemption. And there was also another NFL player, Michael Vick, from the Philadelphia Eagles, who was involved in dog killing. If there had been an actual tape seeing this man kill dogs, I think he would never play in the NFL, but he served his time in prison. He got help, mentored Tony Dungy, a former prominent coach and player, helped him.
All right, I need to hold you there. Do you believe in redemption on this issue, Goldie?
Absolutely, and I think she's absolutely right about this. From all that I've heard about Ray Rice's situation, that he's been acting more responsibly post the situation than the NFL has. That he and his wife are now in family counseling, that they have both actually gone and become born-again Christians, that he has cut out alcohol, which he believes was a huge driver for this, and that they are surrounding themselves with positive influences and friends. So they kind of work their way through this as a couple. I think all of those supports are absolutely necessary, and it's heartening to know that he's taking the steps and that he will dedicate himself, you know, lifelong to this issue. But, you know, in terms of how we eradicate abuse, it doesn't begin and end with the victim. It begins with the abuser themselves. It begins with education and re-education of largely those men who are involved. I work with a group here in Atlanta called Men Stopping Violence, and it is exactly that. It is about turning abusers into helpers, into turning them into healers. It is about helping them through that redemption that they all need. And so do I believe that people should lose their jobs for lifetimes? Absolutely, I don't. But I do think that they should be able to earn their way back. And so in terms of people like Adrian Peterson or Ray Rice, the NFL is really a publicly held institution because it's a nonprofit and our tax dollars going to paying for these stadiums and really helping with these salaries and such. And so they really are accountable to us as well. And so I think that we ought to be a part of that healing process, that we ought to support them through that process that they commit to and open the door when they're ready, if ever, to come back. I think Michael Vick served 2 years in federal prison. He's done an awful lot of work as an animal rights activist post his imprisonment. And so he really earned his way back to the field and has led, by all accounts, a very outstanding life.
Thanks, Aline. And thanks, Goldie. We want to talk to you about your film when it's out. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Goldie Taylor, political analyst and on-air contributor at MSNBC. Thanks to Scott Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll do follow-ups to this show down the road. Thanks for listening.